Waste a lot of time just bullshitting with these old men. There's a lot of them. There's an article in Sailing Magazine this month about is Georgetown. I think it's someplace in the
old men bullshit.
Yeah.
And here, let's get the show underway. Yeah. October 31st, 2009. It's the Watt from Pedro show.
Thank you. the terror of knowing what this world is about. Watching some good friend screaming, let me out. Great tomorrow gets me higher. But you're people are chipping around, pick my brains on the floor. These are the days it never rains, but it's hard.
For Pedro Show, start off with John Coltrane, Goldsboro Express, and then Under Pressure, Petra Haden doing her a cappella version. Sorry, not very Halloween-y of tunes, except anything by Bowie's kind of Halloween-y. It is Halloween, the only day of the year we admit we wear costumes, so of course it's my favorite holiday. I'm in San Pedro, but not in the Love Grotto at the Pleasure Point. I'm here by Daniel Field at Skipper Jeff's pad. Thanks for having me aboard, Skipper Jeff.
Yeah,
first time I've dropped anchor here.
Yeah, more than welcome.
And he's telling me about this morning he was going to go sailing, but the crew lamed out, so he got to talking with some old guys.
Yeah.
And one of these cats, they call the chief, he's 81 years old. He's the second
engineer
on the Lane Victory, which
yeah.
is, we have a victory ship here in Pedro. You know, a lot of the wars, well, all of them except maybe the Civil and the Revolutionary one, fought overseas, so I guess the one with Mexico, that was neighbor war. But we needed a lot of boats because they became the highways to get all the stuff out, so they created this huge like pipeline of these quickly built ships, especially in the Second War. Started off with Liberty ships and then ended up kind of more... a little better version, more improved.
They're larger.
They're larger. They could go faster.
Yeah.
But the whole idea was, you know, they weren't like huge like fighting ships. This was just to get stuff over there from Chonies to gasoline to, you know, K-rations, all kinds of stuff. It all had to be brought over by boat, most of it. And some of these ships, I mean, they were... building them in Terminal Island, the shipyard. I think the motors came from back east, but the record for one of them, they got one done in 3 days or something.
Yeah.
They were like jamming these things together. It was a musician named Henry Kaiser, guitarist. He's from the family. Kaiser, not a boat guy, I think aluminum, steel, some kind of metal.
Well, that would make sense.
But he got into the boat business and got into making these Econo. They had no plans for them lasting that long, just enough to do the job. And the fact that the Lane Victory is still together is a testament to the people volunteering to run her. A lot of them are older cats. I did, more than 10 years ago, a video for Contemplating the Engine Room opera, first opera, Liberty Calls with Spike Jones, and we snuck in. Well, we paid $3, but we filmed down there when we were in the engine room, and after that in the propeller shaft room all the way. If you've been down there, they've got a wooden the gasket, or whatever you want to call it, the fitting around the screw is wood, and it's got some kind of a channel that's been it has like a thread in it, so the water won't come through, and it still can
probably call it, like on my little sailboat, it's called a packing gland, which on my boat, you know, there's a coupling in the drive shaft, and then it's sealed with like a piece of waxy rope, so the drive shafts are actually meant to leak a little bit, you know, because you know, not when the ship stopped, but when it's moving, so it keep cools the friction down. So I don't know. I've been in the engine room. I haven't seen what you're
talking. I went all the way back to that.
I'm guessing that might be
that drive shaft is huge.
Yeah.
Telephone poles. Yeah. You know, it's the motor's midships. Yeah. Like the whole midships is motor.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's a diesel turbo.
Steam turbine.
A steam turbine.
A diesel engine, I think. You know, create.
No, they use diesel to fire the boiler. It's using diesel oil.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what doing. Yeah. And they get the steam up in those turbines, though, which I don't think the Liberty ships had.
Yeah.
I think they had reciprocating motors or something.
Yeah, they probably traditional steam.
They had a reciprocating motor in there in the Fort Bay that was used on the sand pebbles.
It's still there.
It's still there. It's all painted white.
Yeah. I talked.
So small.
Talked to the chief this morning, and you know,
Sam Pebbles was a movie with Steve McQueen, by the way.
I brought up the term Black Gang, and he responded to that first time I ever brought it up with him. Because
I remember some guy doing a review of my first opera and saying I made that up.
Yeah. Well, I wonder the first time I heard it. You know.
Yeah, it's old. I learned it from my pop.
Well, I saw Sam Pebbles recently.
When they say it.
I heard it, yeah.
Well, he says, Black Gang don't do watch.
That's right.
Don't hold watch.
And
on this boat they do.
That's right. According to Richard.
Don't stand watch.
Yeah. That's
it. On this boat. Well, yeah, I mean, that was like I think it was a Spanish gunboat that got, you know, it was a trophy from, or a spoil from our war with Spain over Philippines.
Oh, okay.
In Cuba, the Spanish-American war. And so it wasn't a U.S. boat to begin with, but it wasn't that big. You know, it was a river boat. I don't think it was blue water kind of thing. And so, and also, there wasn't a lot the sailors did do because they had Chinese doing almost all the work.
Yeah.
If you follow the plot of that story, it's China in the 20s, just before, you know, they're getting tired of a lot of puppet mastery from foreigners.
The skipper wanted Holman?
No, Holman is Steve McQueen.
He's right. The skipper didn't. He wanted him to train the coolie, or replacement coolie for the one that died, to run the engine and learn it, because he wanted.
Holman. Yeah, that's right. Holman wanted him to really learn. That's what they would do with the coolies.
To be a soldier. Holman.
Yeah, but Holman wanted to teach him. If you read the book by Richard McKenna, it's even more intense.
Yeah, right.
But what they were doing so these people wouldn't really have power is they called it monkey see and stuff. They just show them what to do. They wouldn't really teach them the theory behind the stuff. And Holman, you're talking about Collins. He's a skipper, but I think he's only a lieutenant. He thinks McQueen, Holman, don't have good leadership qualities, you know. He don't like authority, which he don't. In fact, he likes machines. He likes the engine room. He likes the motor because it doesn't lie. And its logic's very apparent and self-evident. Right? You don't respect it, it kills you.
Yeah.
That's what he said happened to Chin. Yeah. Chin was the coolie running the thing. Didn't dig him going down under the boilerplates. And, you know, hey, this is my motor. I'm going to go down the boilerplates. So the moon key was rusted in the lock for the crankshaft when they had to stop it, because there's more corruption than that, because they got the whole propeller shaft a little askew, so it'd be burn and barren, so they'd always have to be, you know, make work, replacing burns.
Yeah.
It's probably Lapai who was the head coolie. And, you know, it's a lot about the Navy and this stuff, but even more, it's about humanity and just how weird people
are. I draw parallels to the way he, you know, talks about the engine and like if you've ever read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, how you find logic in mechanical devices, that, and literally the title of that book kind of says it all, you know.
Wow.
And I read that book when I was in my 20s, but, you know, that was...
Well, Pohan, to get this concept over so he could actually know how a steam motor runs, he uses allegory of the dragons getting tired.
Oh, wow.
Right? They get tired and put it through the condenser, turn it to water, heat it up. Yeah, the one thing they're not allowed to touch, though, is the throttle. See, and he gets in big trouble for letting Pohan handle the throttle. Yeah, there's some weird... There's a whole bunch of weird stuff in that movie. But that movie and the book, too. You got to read the book. Richard McKenna, he did many years in the Navy, maybe 23, in the engine room as a machinist mate. That's why when I first... I didn't know it was a book until I was torn with... Porno for Pyros, and I was walking around one morning after the gig in Pittsburgh, and I saw it there. Wow, this is a book, because it was me and D. Boone's favorite movie. Came out in 66, but it was a book from the early 60s. I guess it was hard to get that thing going for a movie. Robert Wise ends up directing it. The pick for the star was supposed to be Paul Newman, which was Steve McQueen's huge competition.
That's right.
And end up McQueen got the... Yeah. Maybe they wouldn't give him the award, but I think he got a nomination.
Yeah.
And
it was epic back then. I saw... Actually, my parents took me to see it in the theater in 66.
Right when it came out.
We just moved to Bremerton, Washington, and you know, it was a big Navy town.
That's
we
right.
used to have... every Thanksgiving, we'd have a sailor over that was in transit for Thanksgiving, but...
You saw it when it came out. I didn't see it until it was on the TV. Me and D. Boone watched it. It'd be one of those ones that was 2 days.
That's right.
Because it was a long movie.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal. But the book, Richard McKenna, you got to read that.
Yeah.
Because it really... I was just a boy and I couldn't really understand what was going on in the movie. But the book... As soon as I started reading it, I knew this guy was a Navy man because... It sounded so much like my father speaking. It was like crazy, man. This guy couldn't just hung out with sailors for a couple of weeks. He had to be one. And I found out he's actually from Idaho, a place called Mountain Home, but went to the Navy. Ended up retiring to Chapel Hill, married a librarian. Chapel Hill reminds me of my father because he retired to Fresno where there's no ocean. Like Chapel Hill. Tells you about the Navy.
Yeah.
And he thought if you're going to be a writer, you read a bunch of Faulkner and Hemingway and just go for it. But then he wrote some science fiction, but the only novel he wrote was Sand Pebbles. It's a great study on humanity, you know, going through... The idea of the military, the Navy especially, and being in foreign land.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was, for 1966, pretty understandable because the Vietnam thing's really getting going then.
Kind of showed a microcosm of, like, you know, just social statements at the time, you know, with the politics. But it was all it was just this little remote area on the river, you know.
In China.
Yeah.
Not even the Yangtze, a smaller
one. And then you've got everything pulling into place. You've got, you know, the missionaries with the religious efforts, you know, and then the USA trying to, you know, hold their position in the East, and then you've got the Bolsheviks coming in, you know, the new communists. What era was that? It's like,
yeah, they fight with them some, but the main guys they deal with are Kuomintang, which is Shang. But both Bolshevik and nationalists, they both want China free of foreigners. Well, maybe the Bolsheviks wanted Russians, but for sure, well, it turned out, no, they didn't, because Mao had a way of dealing with them. But they, you know, it had been a couple hundred years of them opened up by foreigners.
Yeah.
And this was the big reaction, paying off warlords, keeping China weak.
Yeah.
And so this, you know... times were coming for change. And the other microcosm of that situation is on the boat. They got coolies doing all the work. The captain's got, or the skipper's got, two sets of books. He's got one for the Navy and one for him and Lopai, who's the head coolie. These guys are doing everything from making the chow and cutting the hair and shaving to doing all the painting, all the cleaning, running everything. In fact, the motor, which Holman, the new recruit, has trouble with because he's an engine man. He likes machines. He can't stay on one boat for long. He always has a problem with authority. He thinks a lot of the crap is look-see for officers and just posing and fronting and all this facade and nothing for real. You know, what's real is a machine. It works or not. Yeah. It gets you there. You can understand it by learning its sounds, when it's healthy, when it's sick. You can't tell with people.
Yeah.
He's got a huge distrust. But he gets a protege in the form of a young coolie named Pohan, and he ends up having to shoot him because Bolsheviks got him on the beach and are torturing him.
That left an imprint on my mind when I saw, as a...
Which is hell to pay because he owned some little stuff. He was saving up his money. Yeah. But because of all the exploitation of landlords and stuff like this, he got scapegoated into a weird situation. He was just... Yeah, so sad about Pohan.
Yeah.
And his name, Holman, Pohan. In fact, the crew starts calling him a Homang, making fun of him because he's too close.
I see.
Because the other thing you forget, or you didn't mention about the 60s and those times, that's really addressed in that movie, is racism.
Yeah.
Big time. Yeah. And the U.S. was going through that with the civil rights at the time. And you actually couldn't even marry an Asian lady if you were a sailor. And this is what happens with Frenchie. He ends up dying. One of the cool crew guys to Holman is Frenchie.
Yeah.
And he gets pneumonia swimming on over and dies in an alley.
Yeah.
Mei Li. She's rescued from being sold. You know, some crap debt of her family or something she had to help pay off by selling her body and... All this, yeah, it's quite a... She ends up getting murdered and Holman gets blamed for that.
Yeah.
Gangsters kill her. And then, you know, the crew is convinced that Holman is the Jonah. They had it really good, you know. I think that when he comes over, at one point one of them says, she ain't pretty, but she's a feeder. You know, like they got good shouting.
Yeah.
That's one of the first things. And reading about Richard McKenna later, he was saying the point about my point I was trying to make about the military. It's run on something called military fear. And once they lose that, everything goes to hell.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't Holman. He's kind of, like Pohan, a scapegoat for the situation that they're kind of responsible for. Everybody was. You know, but there you are stuck in it. Now, what's up to you is what a person can do in their life. Even though big nation things are happening with China, it's still made up of all these little personal trips.
Yeah.
And in fact, with the missionaries, because Holman's going to jump ship. He's going to go and work on their motors. And the lady, Candace Bergen, her... favorite student is a very enlightened China guy, young guy who ends up getting sacrificed. You know, it's too big. The things are happening. The momentum, people, mobs, everything gets so crazy that even with your little choices, but for all the Jonah and all the hell that they put on Holman, he's the one who ends up saving their lives. And it's very interesting how he does it too, because the revolutionaries are coming over the wall. And he uses their name. He's calling out like
that's
they're
right.
all there.
Yeah.
He's using their names.
Yeah.
He's the only one left.
Right.
But they fool him and buys him enough time. And then the very sad ending, you know. I was almost home.
Exactly.
What went wrong?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah. Like I was saying, I think I would have been 10 years old when I saw it. So, you know, I was really just... impressionable. It was kind of shocking for a young kid, you know, and I don't think my parents knew what I was in for, because that scene where he had to shoot the...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, as they were torturing him, they were...
He had him up on sticks and were pulling skin off his ribs.
Yeah, it's powerful stuff.
Death by a thousand cut kind of trip.
So it's like that movie's always just kind of, you know, played in the back of my mind. And then, you know, I start to listening to your show and meet you and realize how important the book was. And, you know, at 10 years old, that's kind of up in Washington State. That's when I first got into sailing, and I was living by the ocean. Before that, we lived in Northern California. And so it's just kind of all tied in, you know. My dad was Navy. He was lieutenant. You know, it's just a powerful movie that's just kind of been with me, always in the back of my mind. But I will read the book.
Yeah, the Navy thing was a trip. Because it identified me too, you know, my father.
Of course.
And but there's a lot of human universal things in there that are bigger than just the Navy and stuff like that, in Asia even. Just how humans treat each other, think about themselves. You know, he was looking for something to believe in, but he just couldn't handle bullshit. Just couldn't handle it.
Yeah, he was a... transfer, right? In the beginning of the
right away, they got him with the duffel bag.
Yeah.
He wants to, they won't even let him carry his own sack.
Yeah.
You know? And the real... I guess in the book, you know more. He's an orphan.
Well, I kind of assume that.
Yeah, you can tell he has movie. No... And Steve McQueen had an alcoholic prostitute mother. I think he could identify with the role of Jay Coleman, too.
I just learned recently, I was surprised that he... He went out rough. I didn't realize he was...
Oh, cancer. He was a good actor, though.
Awesome actor.
All right, some music.
Happy on.
We'll be right back.
blah.
Okay, back, yeah, talking about the politics and stuff. I played some songs there. That was Guitars by Tenko, then Politics of Hate by Bass Army, and then Lame Talking by Toban Jizan. Some trippy stuff from Japan. Dirk's birthday's tomorrow at 3 o'clock at the Red Man Hall on Shepherd.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Tonight I play in Orange County, the Doll Hut. Doll Hut was an old roadhouse that's been there for years, more than 40. It's like inland Orange County, so like I-5,
Anaheim.
Yeah. Disneyland.
What time do you come on?
Last, probably. Playing with three other bands, I think OC bands. And, I try to play every Halloween. I ain't going to wear a pumpkin tonight. I've done it, what, 5-6 years in a row now, and so I got another thing. Last night I played with the outfit on in Glendale. And I played this bass or whatever. It had four strings on it, but it was this long-ass pole that Grux, his cat from... He's a young man. Well, he was a young man when I met him. 82 or something. Minuteman gig. He still looks young, though, man, for being 27 years ago. And he's got a band. He's got a couple bands, but one of them is called Rubber O Cement, and he wears these incredibly strange outfits and makes sounds. He's got this thing called the Javelin Bass or something, and it's a big-ass pole with plexiglass and runs it through sounds and kind of makes sounds like the Godzilla movies. You know. And so, okay, I'll play with you. And Lourdes came up with this outfit, big sock with the head thing on it that went over my face, or over my head, actually, and then some kind of flannel wing, and then a, which was kind of stupid because I was, well, I was stupid to wear flannel with it, so, and then some kind of wax sack. That had stuff hanging. It was very strange.
She made your costume.
Yeah, well, it was Grux's instructions, a friend of Grux's. And I had no idea what it was. I just said, I'll do it. And then, but the strap, it was hard to get this strap to stay on my shoulder and work this thing. It was very long. It was, I don't know, 8 feet.
A homemade?
Yeah.
Base rig?
Yeah.
It got strings that long?
It had string. No. The scale was, well, maybe it was a little longer. But the thing itself was this big pole. Actually, it was two pieces of aluminum with a board between it, which ended up the fretboard too, but no frets. And very strange. It was kind of hard for me to play. And but what really made it hard was it not staying on my shoulder. And then the head that was heavy, it was hard to keep that thing, even though the sock over my whole head kind of kept it on there. It was like a mushroom kind of deal, you know, where my head was the stem and then this big cap thing was and ears on it.
I'm getting visions of Gawar.
Didn't you even get a picture?
Gawar.
I flowed you a shot of it.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, I better.
If you go look at it, you'll see exactly what I mean.
Well, I was about to say I'm getting visions of Gawar meets.
Here, go look at it.
Oh, I got.
Yeah.
started off with Bass Is My Boyfriend by Heavy Grinder. And Julie Told Susie by Gravity of the Situation. Gravity of the Situation is a solo project by the bass player of this next band, Telomere Repair, a Long Beach band. And they did Tugboat / Jet Boat. And we played with them, second man played with them last week at Alex's. In fact, Alex was a bass player in the band before us called Los Misteriosos. It was great. Incredible singer, singing all kind of Mexicano folk songs, all rocked up.
Cool.
Yeah, they were great. And then we heard Cut With Me by OG. So, I think he's 16 years old out of England. And he's learning how to record and make sounds. Learn how to play everything. Hey, which is great, man. I wish I had that nerve when I was 16.
Yeah.
Me and D Boom were trying to find. Oh, wait, now you saw the picture, so yeah. Now you understand the bass.
Yeah.
The string length ain't that big, but the instrument itself is.
It is double the length of the strings.
Yeah. I think he called it an ace instead of a bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's this big aluminum. It didn't weigh a lot, but I actually had to prop one in on the deck because I couldn't get the strap to go over my shoulder.
Four strings?
Four.
Yeah.
But I don't know if it was tuned or anything. I don't know. He had it going through the PA, and you know, since no frets, I was using a lot of the glissandro and stuff. And but you can see too, the headdress or whatever you want to call it was difficult.
See, you don't need to look at your fingers when you're playing anymore after all these years, do you?
Yeah,
I don't see how you can see anything with that headdress on.
Oh, it's a sock.
Yeah.
So you can see through it.
I got you.
Okay, but yeah, the real tough one, like pumpkins, are hard to see what's going on, for sure. And hard to kind of breathe. And really hard for the singing mic.
Yeah.
Yeah, to get it.
You probably smelled pumpkin for a week after that being
up. Yeah, but I like pumpkin. I've made pumpkin pies with the insides a lot.
Yeah.
So you can see the situation last night. That was quite a challenge. And then I didn't show you Grux's costume, but his was even more intense. He had sacks of stuff hanging off every part of his body, and he was running all around. Like I said, it was sort of like one of them Godzilla, Monster Zero,
right.
Gamera, Rodan movies.
A big rubber.
Right, and they're bouncing around. That's how, and he made sounds like that with his bass.
Latex, I think they did a lot of use with the latex.
You know. Yeah, and laser beams out the mouth. He didn't have laser beams. But Eric Bloom used to shoot one out of his wrist.
Yeah.
I remember at the end of.
Yeah, they had big. Those shows were so expensive with the laser beams and a big hassle. Their roadie has been doing some elaborate posts on a...
For safety.
A couple of websites. Hot Reels to Hull is a guy named Ralph in England that, is the new documentarian of the band.
Yeah.
Recontour. Yeah, but man, there's some stories of
that's what a roadie is, isn't he? He's a storyteller.
Oh, okay. Yeah. The stories from the roadies are better than you'd ever hear from the band. The band has no idea what's going on, you know, a lot of times, you know. But he went into detail about how the cooling systems they had for those lasers, and then they had all of these environmental groups and people just on them, you know, concerned about the places catching on
people.
Fire, and and
it was green. It was green lasers.
Yeah,
it wasn't like you would think the red. Yeah. They were green ones.
Yeah, and then they bounce. They had mirrors on the back of the guitars too, and then they'd hold those up.
Oh,
and
really?
They'd bounce. Oh, yeah.
Maybe this is later. When I saw him, he had one that came out of his wrist.
Yeah.
And what he bounced them off was a spinning disco mirror ball.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it went shooting all over the place.
Yeah.
And then they had some kind of one that would wave back and forth for the beginning of Harvester of Eyes.
Yeah. I think The Who actually did the lasers first, but I'd have to research that more. But they just about exhausted all their monies. They were losing monies on those laser tours, you know. But that was their peak, 76, you know, 75, 76.
I think 75 is the last time I saw.
The band?
Yeah. I saw him do Soft White Underbelly in Pedro here, maybe in 80.
Oh, yeah.
But that wasn't like...
You know about that show. That was a...
Albert was playing. And I didn't realize until I talked to Albert many years later.
These are pictures from that show.
I remember Albert having a blinky bow tie.
Well, when I showed this to Bola, the former head of the BOC fan club, he goes, he recognized that blurry shot as Albert.
Yeah. And well, I didn't know it was Albert until I talked to him later.
This is the Waters. And
it's on 14th Pacific.
A buddy of mine's a professional photographer. He worked for the Pasadena Weekly at the time. He took these. But when I showed it to Bull, he goes, oh, man, that was this brief tour. They'd kicked Albert out of the band.
I know, and he brought him back.
They were hanging. They didn't have a drummer for a while. And
But it was not called Blue Oyster Cult. It was called Soft White.
Yes, that's correct.
But we're at the end of the first hour here. We've got more BOC in that. Well, no, hour two, we got an interview with Ron Ashton in February of 2001, so hold tight for that. October 31st, 2009, Happy Halloween, second hour of the Watt from Pedro show. And here's an interview John Griffin did with Ron Ashton in February 27th of 2001. At WCBN at Ann Arbor, in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And, a bunch of interesting stuff from Ronnie. Watt from Peter show. Oh, big thanks for John for letting me have this.
Here we are.
Yeah, back at wonderful WCBN.
You've been down here many times.
Oh,
before.
Yeah, Destroy All Monsters days.
Right.
Sitting in guest DJ, playing live, actually, also.
Uh-huh.
I haven't been here in a while, but it's cool. It hasn't changed.
Right on.
A little bit rattier, a little cooler.
Ann Arbor's changed a lot, though, you say.
Oh, yeah.
How do you view that in a lot of sense? I mean, being
crowded,
part of...
traffic jams, new ugly buildings.
Right.
It's changed a lot.
Right. And a lot of the energy's kind of different, I guess, too.
Yeah. And there's still plenty of music, a lot of people playing.
There is.
Which is cool. There's always plenty of bands, good people, good musicians.
Right on.
Ann Arbor does keep on in that sense.
Yeah. There's something about this town, too. You know, I'm not from here, from Massachusetts. I kind of just end up here by accident.
Most people do.
Yeah, it's kind of funny like that, yeah. And it's kind of, you know, that's the kind of charm about this town, besides the fact it's got this good history. But even at any point in history, this town seems to be a pretty decent place.
Yep.
But, so speaking of history, I want to give a little background first. I know that a lot of people may not be too familiar with you personally. A lot of people, a lot of times, hear a lot more about Iggy with the Stooges, but tonight we're gonna focus on Ron and who he is and where he came from. You started off your first musical influences were as a reading. A lot of this is from an interview from Jason Gross, who I have to give credit to because there's a lot of great stuff on there. But you started off playing accordion. You had some relatives that were involved in vaudeville.
Yes, my great aunt Ruthie and uncle Dick. Mm-hmm. They actually had a trained parakeet act, and he played piano, and she played the banjo and violin. And they used to put on shows for me. They were long retired. Mm-hmm. But good old Dick, the alcoholic, would sit at the piano still with his last parakeet, Petey, covered in bird crap and play piano for me. Then Ruthie would come in, play some banjo, a little violin.
Uh-huh.
So she gave me an old violin to start out with. Because I used to just sit there while everyone else was in the backyard having the clam bake.
Uh-huh.
But I just sit there and listen to Dick play and listen to the stories.
Uh-huh.
And she gave me the old violin and I used to scratch away on it. So my mother took it away and turned it into a planter.
Uh-huh.
And so she got me an accordion.
Uh-huh.
So I started taking accordion lessons when I was five.
What do you think it was about music that attracted you to it? I mean, obviously, it's an influence.
Well, I always loved the singing cowboys when I was a kid, Roy Rogers and Gene Autry.
Uh-huh.
So that sort of got me into it. I was always into movies.
Uh-huh.
So here you got the singing cowboys, their shows with music, cowboy action and music.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what really got me going. And once again, to actually hear live music, my aunt, great aunt and uncle actually playing.
Mm-hmm.
Just the sound, it was fascinating to hear the live sound.
Why not? So eventually you moved on to guitar. Like, how old were you started playing guitar?
10. I was still taking accordion, so I'd exchange. Mm-hmm. One Saturday I'd do accordion, and the next Saturday guitar.
Mm-hmm. What kind of music influenced you at the time to pick up guitar? I mean, obviously rock and roll was still pretty young.
I just liked all the classical, not classical music, but the standard contemporary music of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like Peggy Lee and all just Frank Sinatra.
Right.
My mother was way into music, so she had a really big record collection.
Uh-huh.
She actually used to sing when she was younger. She actually sang on the radio, CKLW.
Yeah, I saw that in one of the interviews. She sang on the radio, CKLW?
Well, yeah, but that's, of course, before I was born, when
right,
she was
right.
a teenager.
Okay.
So she had a lot of music around the house.
Mm-hmm.
She had a great record collection. We always had a great stereo.
And she supported.
Yeah, I just listened to her tunes. She'd have music on all the time. So I just, I was born to do this anyways. I guess you're supposed to. It's my destiny.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So just having music around all the time, I just got in playing. All the kids were out playing softball or riding their bikes around. I mostly stay in the house and listen to music. So I got kicked out. Get out. You got to get out in the sunshine.
Uh-huh. So you're playing guitar for a while, you're doing that thing, and eventually you had this kind of thing where you wanted to start, or you decided you wanted to go to England to go see the Beatles.
Well, actually, what happened was I took lessons, and then I stopped for a while. And then that's what happened, Bob Dylan and the Beatles, I started listening to Bob Dylan, so I got out the old little Martin and would strum along and picked it up again.
Right.
And used to go to... which is really corny. I'd go to Herb David's. I'd be like 17 when he was on State Street, and I'd have my tweed jacket and my brown corduroys. And I'd smoke my $2 pipe with a little cherry blend. 17-year-old kid just hanging out at Herb's pretending he's cool.
Right.
And I wound up, there was a folk club. It was called Bimbo's, I believe. It was a pizza parlor, and they had like Josh White Jr. They had nationally known or up-and-coming folk singers.
Where was Bimbo's at?
Really? It was in Washington or something. It was near here.
Okay.
It was just a pizza parlor. I can't remember, but you'd go and there was, a small cover, and we'd get a pizza, but, go and drink like 12 cups of coffee and stay there the whole time. So that's what got me into music. Then, of course, seeing the Beatles totally got me geeked on it. So Dave Alexander and I, Dave wanted to go to England. So he goes, hey, I'm going to England. Would you like to go? I'm going, yeah, but I'm in high school. And junior year, good student. So I did. My mom let me go, and I sold my motorcycle to get my ticket, and we took off, and that was no turning back after that. Once being there on your own at 17 in England, we thought we were going to see the Stones walking the street.
Yeah, where's Ringo?
Of course, it wasn't like that. It was the heavy mod and rocker time.
Right.
And we were actually chastised by both sides. We were caught in a time warp. Dave looked like George Harrison style, and I was into Brian Jones, so we had long hair, and we didn't look like anybody, the rockers or the mods. So, but it was still a great experience to go and be away. And once I came back...
How long were you there for?
Just a month.
Yeah, really?
But that's all they would allow us to stay with the money we had.
Right, right, right.
But just that changed my whole life. There was no turning back.
Yeah.
Goodbye, normal 9-to-5. Goodbye, world.
So
freak here.
I know you got thrown out of school, but you from Pioneer High.
Well, I was the first to get expelled for long hair.
Wow, that's a good honor.
And I was called down to the principal's office, and he says, you're a disrupting influence on the rest of the students. I've never gotten a fight.
Uh-huh.
I'm a good student. And just the way I look, I'm disrupting the whole school.
Well, we share a common box. I was thrown out of high school for a mohawk. So.
Yes!
Cheers. And a Catholic school, no less. Right? Explains why I'm here today. So at the time, though, was there a lot of stuff that for kids your age to do? I mean, you're not old enough to really get into bars really as much yet. And musically, was there stuff to go do and that kind of thing? I mean, you mentioned Bimbos, but...
Yeah, not really. You kind of made up stuff yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
We'd kind of go to... I was actually got in a high school band while I was still in school, The Chosen Few.
Yeah, okay.
And that was with Scott Richardson, who went on to be in the SRC.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we played every weekend. So it was really cool to be that young and making almost a couple hundred bucks a week playing on weekends. So we were at a lot of fraternity parties. We did the TGIFs at the quads or wherever to do like two jobs a night, either in town there or a frat house, or go out to like Daniel's Den, some of the teen clubs in Birmingham. Maybe there's no liquor, but pop and chips and
kids
girls.
Dancing. Yeah, right.
Cool because we looked like the Rolling Stones. And
right.
But what was really fun is the fraternity parties, especially the Sammies, the Med House, because they'd set pictures of screwdrivers on our amps.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, by the end of the night, I was the only one. Somebody had to drive. So everybody else, my brother was the equipment man.
Oh, right.
He's okay. Out in the van in a puddle of puke. And, you know, I was the only one that was responsible. Everybody else is blasted.
Right.
But that was fun at the frat parties, too.
Right on. Right.
So that's what we did.
Mm-hmm. You also did a stint in the Prime Movers for a short time also, like by Michael Irwin. You want to talk about that a little bit? What was that like?
Yeah, that was cool. I knew Iggy, and just from school and in passing. I didn't really know him in school. I kind of met him more when we used to go to the Michigan Union cafeteria to hang out, even though we get kicked out sometimes three, four times in the afternoon. See your IDs. Bing. Right. Always just, you know, wait a half hour, come back.
Right.
So I knew Rick Higginbotham, who later went on to play with Commander Cody. I believe he played bass. So he goes, yeah, I got this cool job in the blues band with Iggy. It wasn't really Iggy back then.
Right. So
it was Michael Irwin that coined. They called him Ignatius because of the iguanas.
Oh, okay.
So Michael Irwin gave him the name Iggy.
Oh, okay.
So I go, wait a minute, you can't play at all, and I can play a little bit. So Iggy goes, well, why don't you come and audition also? So I felt bad for my buddy because he just got the job, but I went and I got the job. They had me play. I could do just 1-4-5. I wasn't really that accomplished on bass, but they had me sing "Not Fade Away." And I think what clinched it for me is I sang "The Girl from Ipanema." And I went, "What?" They had the Prime Movers songbook. It was like 4 inches thick of just all these songs that they knew and could cover.
Right.
And I went, "What?" So.
So
they played it, and I sang, and I got the job.
Was that the kind of new experience for you? Like I said, it was a little more professional.
Oh yeah, I thanked them a lot because that was my total learning experience to play with professional musicians. Mm-hmm. They were pretty well accomplished, and I every day after school I'd go and just practice my ass off until
I can say that word.
Okay, until the band practice later on.
Right.
And eventually they did find someone because they had to go on, and I really wasn't good enough.
Right.
So they found a guy named Jack Dawson that really fit in well because he was a good singer, great bass player.
Uh-huh.
So they kept me on as roadie, and I got to play a couple tunes now and then at shows they did in town. And even I went to hang out with them when they were at a bar in Grand Rapids for a month. Every weekend their girlfriends would drive me up, get me drunk.
Good.
And then I play tambourine and some bass.
There you go.
And
there you go.
It was that's how I learned.
Right.
And then when Iggy wanted to learn the double shuffle, because they did the great Paul Butterfield Blues Band covers, and Sam Lay had that double shuffle. And I got to practice hours and hours with Jim Iggy, and that's how I actually learned how to play. And then the Chosen Few, I learned to play all my favorite Beatles and Stones, Yardbirds, Kink songs in the high school cover band.
And also another thing about mentioning the Chosen Few, I read in one interview with Jason Gross that you were also the first person to strike the first chord at the Grandy Ballroom in Detroit as well.
That's with the Chosen Few. The very first was Jeep Holland, who was the assistant manager and Discount Records, and he was the manager of the Rationals. He gave us this English EP. It was the Stones doing that Everybody Needs Somebody,
right.
Pain in My Heart, and Route 66. And that was our big opener, man. That's three right in a row.
Right on.
Stripped down tunes. So I did the first Bill Wyman. So that, you know, I never thought about it at the time, but that was cool. We opened up for the MC5.
Right on. Right
and that's
on.
How I met the MC5.
Right on. You mentioned also the Rationals. I heard another interview that, I guess another experience for everyone to get into rock and roll scene. The Rationals play at Pioneer one time?
Yes.
Look like what I'm talking about?
I was in a jug band with Bill Kirchen, and he goes, well, we need a harmonica player. I go, oh, gee, I can play. So I went home that night and practiced all night.
Uh-huh.
I go, oh, I can play, yeah. I got the job in the band, so we were waiting to audition for the talent show, and before us was the Rationals, and I really hadn't heard of them, and I didn't know them. My brother went to school with Scott, I believe.
Okay.
And when they played, I was totally blown away. Because here's 15-year-old guys that are playing as well or better than the guys that the songs that wrote the song. Great Beatle covers. They did one of my favorite songs, For Your Love by the Yardbirds. I was totally blown away. I'm going, oh, man, there's no way we're going to get on the talent show. But of course, we did because there wasn't much talent out there. And they start. I had to get to know those guys.
Right. Yeah, Scott Morgan's a great guy.
And my brother knew his brother, and his brother had a spare drum set. So we started borrowing the drum set and stuff. And That's how I got to know Scott Morgan. I was, you know, 15 years old. Jesus. I mean, those guys, they were a great band.
Oh, yeah.
If they hadn't gotten pimped by Aretha Franklin, they had their Cameo Parkway respect, and they were going national, and then she came out with it, and they sort of lost that edge on that tune. But what a great band. And I'm sure Scott's been down here.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, actually, Scott actually will be probably stopped down here a little later on. He's
a little band, but...
What's that?
This guy right now? Oh, that's Scott on the phone as we speak, actually.
We're talking about
him. Yeah, there he is. So let's jump a little jump ahead here since you know, we've got a little formation, like we've got a little idea, like musical history on you. When you came back from England, you decided at one point before you did the Chosen Few and the Prime Movers stuff that you wanted to you and your brother and Dave Alexander all wanted to form a band, and that kind of started out kind of slow at first.
Yes. Well, that was what we did. We basically just played in Dave's bedroom.
Right.
We put on records. We liked The Bells of Rhythmy by the Byrds, and She's About a Mover by the Sir Douglas Quintet, and we'd play along with those tunes.
Mm-hmm.
We had a stereo. He had a great stereo back then, top of the line,
right.
And just blast them. We're going, yeah, man, we're great. Then try without it, and of course, nobody could play at all.
Mm-hmm.
We're going, we need Bill Cheatham, so we got Bill Cheatham in there on rhythm guitar. It was even worse. So we really didn't. We just sort of plugged along, and that's how we kind of learned, eked our way along.
Uh-huh.
We never really played a show or anything,
right.
But we were a very popular band in Ann Arbor, even though we never played.
Yeah, what were you called?
The Dirty Shanes.
The Dirty Shanes, okay.
And that's the core,
uh-huh.
And that's how we became friends, and
uh-huh.
That's how I really became friends with Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Because my brother had met him. We moved into the subdivision, and we'd see this guy going down the road in a 67 in Pella, it was a 65,
mm-hmm.
even like, you know, 80 miles an hour, and it's this wild, crazy guy. Finally, he stopped, and we talked to him.
Okay.
He lives down the street, and that became a great friendship until he died. So that's, we were the core, and then somehow Iggy came aboard.
So how did that all come together? I know, obviously,
well,
you all knew
pretty
each
much
other.
It was pretty much from, Iggy called me up
mm-hmm.
and said, he got me the job in The Chosen Few, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He was working at Discount Records, and Scott Richardson came in, and he said, there's a guy down here that seems pretty cool that's looking for a bass player. So I hung out with Scott all afternoon, and I wound up going back to Birmingham, Michigan with him the next day. And that's how, just me dragging along Dave and my brother, and Iggy, we became friends. Because they were my buddies, and you know, Dave had a car. So that's how
it worked,
yeah, that's how we all hung
out. Right. So you guys started started jamming, and you guys got the thing together. Like,
well,
how did it start
actually, Iggy quit the Prime Movers,
mm-hmm.
and he went to live in Chicago because he was friends with Sam Lay.
Mm-hmm.
Iggy wanted to be a blues drummer,
mm-hmm.
for real.
Mm-hmm.
So Sam took him under his wing and protected him, mm-hmm. took him in all the hardcore clubs, where he was probably the only white kid in there. And
mm-hmm.
it wasn't Big Sam and the 45 shoulder holster.
Right.
Watches his white butt. He could have been in trouble, but finally Jim called up and he had enough. He realized it really wasn't what he was going to want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So he called up and said, hey, why don't you guys come to Chicago and pick me up? And,
Dave's car.
Well, actually, we went with this woman called Vivian, who was the bass player in a band called the Charging Rhinoceros of Soul.
Oh, it was with Steve McKay,
yeah.
Was the leader of Funhouse, right. Okay.
And we picked him up. And brought it, and he said, I want to start a band with you guys. We want to do something totally different, out of context, with just regular,
mm-hmm.
you know, music, not like the Stones or the Beatles. So we got together and just started, he got a Farfisa organ, and we started jamming in my basement, with just weird sounds, like my bass with fuzz tone and wah-wah pedal.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me.
Why do you think you went in that direction, though? Because, I mean, at the time, obviously, a lot of people are like, maybe, like, you know, want to shoot towards, like, this Beatles thing or Stone thing, like you're saying, or maybe, like, kind of go in different directions. But, like, I mean, a lot of the stuff you're talking about was, I mean, besides the fact it was ahead of its time, was also not really very, I mean, there wasn't anything really around you could identify with.
Well,
could you?
It's because of the Who doing things like Happy Jack,
mm-hmm.
them talking about rock opera.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what got us really excited.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, rock and roll opera.
Mm-hmm.
And we loved the Who, and that's before Tommy, but they had mm-hmm. that song Happy Jack, which was such a strange, cool song.
Right.
So we just started putting together just pieces of music, riffs. Iggy would sit down at the Farfisa and come up with a simple kind of thing. I'd follow with a wah-wah and fuzz tone bass and get some brothers some kind of percussion thing going, a modified Bo Diddley beat or conga beat, and just have it go into different segments. All of a sudden shift gears, then go into a different piece of music. So we worked up this hour-long piece of music called The Razor's Edge. And we wow. never really performed it,
right.
other than the one time we first played that Halloween show, which was our first time we ever played. The MC5 were there. It was just a little party at our manager's house.
Where is this here?
This was here in Ann Arbor, just at his house.
Do you remember what the where it was?
The house was on State Street. It's the Gallman, the oil company. Isn't it Gallman right on there State Street?
Okay.
Before Briarwood. Now it's
I see.
The front of the house is a teeny house. It's still there. But they've added a bunch of other things on.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like some architectural design company or something. But eventually it went from that to the Grandy shows where we really learned to play, where we made up our own instruments. And finally, that's when Dave really got in the band, other than Dave just taking the custom amp and crashing the head to get that good sound.
Yeah.
He played all the weird percussion, the vacuum cleaner with the microphone. I said, well, I'm going to play guitar, Dave play bass. So we kind of naturally gravitated to the format that the Stooges became on the first record.
What do you think drove you to do that? Because at certain points in time, it's naturally been a sort of anomaly that exists where people just all of a sudden, like, they don't even know exactly how, like, the history's gone, but they just naturally just kind of just, like, created some racket. What do you think it was that just made you at that time, and when everybody else is, like, you know, hippieing out and stuff, what made you want to go crazy?
Because we were.
Good answer. Survey says. So you're doing the shows and you're playing a lot with the five and stuff, and eventually you get this offer.
That's how we really learned to play.
Right.
Russ Gibb loved us. We were the freaks of the Grandy.
Right.
So we get all, you know, great lineup, have us do our freak show and the MC5 do their high energy rock show. So we just played. We actually learned to play our instruments by playing shows.
Uh-huh.
We got better and better, and then, you know, the rest of the tale is we got signed by Electric as the MC5 was signed, and Danny Field saw us at the Michigan Union Ballroom, and they go, well, we were still doing freeform pieces of music, like start a riff, and just we were playing for 15, 20 minutes, half hour.
What was it like playing at the ballroom? I've seen the video that...
It was always fun because it was a happening.
Right.
It was always... everyone showed up.
Right.
It was a guaranteed good show. Everyone had a good time.
It's a damn shame that the kids aren't putting shows on there now.
And it was a fun place, yes. And it was, back then, people really got behind it.
Mm-hmm.
And it always filled the place. I mean, whoever played, it was always a good time. The only weird thing was, like, they were pretty good about, no one got rowdy and there was never fights. Of course, you couldn't have alcohol or tobacco or marijuana, but people would find ways to walk around and keep moving.
Right.
Just got to keep moving
and
never get tagged. And no one started any trouble
and
messed the place up, so it was cool. I even stayed sometimes to clean up afterwards, just hang out.
All right.
That's there how much go. People were into using the place.
True humanitarian, right on. That's what I like. So we talked about, we had the signing there at Letra. You went to New York and worked with John Cale to do the first album. Now, what kind of experience was that? Had you recorded this at this point?
I'd never been in the recording studio.
Uh-huh.
It was really fun. We're in New York. We're in New York.
Kind of a field trip for you guys?
Yeah. Well, I'd been a couple times before.
Right.
Like, literally going with my brother and a band full of people.
Right.
I had $20. I'm going, my brother doesn't have any money, so here's $10 for you, $10 for me. And just live on orange
juices
and everyone's asleep on the floor of the Earl Hotel with cockroaches running over our faces.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, it was fun going to New York. We actually, what a dream. It happened so fast. Here we are, young guys who were signed by a record company that the Doors are on.
Right. So that must make kind of a thing for you guys, too, because I know you guys are big Doors.
And we never recorded in, John Cale, Velvet Underground, cool. We knew some about them and liked the stuff.
Right.
And it was his first job as a staff producer.
Uh-huh.
So...
And you guys at this time also were living, now this is when you were living on Forest Court, is that correct?
No, that was just our summer sublet.
That was the summer sublet. Oh, so you just lived there for a short time.
Yeah,
in the 67,
we were sort of in between. I think we had just moved into what became known as Stooge Hall, that was on Packard.
Okay, right.
The great old farmhouse that was subdivided into apartments. Fantastic, perfect, even the bands today. I mean, I wish I lived there today.
Right.
It was such a huge, great, fantastic house. There was nothing there at the time, so we could get away, except for one neighbor would always call the cops on us. But we went to New York, and that's how we worked up the tunes. We told Elektra, they said, well, do you have any songs? And we go, oh, yeah, sure.
Right.
So basically, I just started kicking out riffs and pieces, and Iggy and myself put together those tunes.
So you didn't
wrote
actually
the lyrics.
Did you actually?
No,
have
we had
tunes?
No songs.
There were no songs.
We got signed with no tunes.
Wow, that's amazing.
We were just doing that jam. We were just doing that half an hour piece of music. Oh, sure, we got tunes.
So how did,
we had a couple weeks, so we put the tunes together.
So how did you go from, like, you know, I mean, obviously the pressure was on. You had to write tunes for the record. But how did you? I mean, that's a lot of, like, pressure to write such an album that's such a classic.
Hey, we work best under pressure.
You know,
I love it.
Right.
Pressure always. Just about everything I've ever written, even when I did the Wild Rat stuff. Oh, gee, we're making the record in 1 week. I better write some tunes. So we just work well under pressure.
Uh-huh.
And when you're young and crazed, anything's possible.
Why do you think the record stood around for so long? I mean, it's been obviously a major influence on a lot of people, and it's still, it beats the, you know, half the records that are out there now. What do you think of this?
It's
about
simple.
It
tells a simple truth. Mm-hmm. It's like pure form of a rock and roll or early punk.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It just speaks to that young mind, rebellious mind, and the music just, it conveys as I played. I mean, that's what I felt. You can feel the soul and the truth in the playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's honest. I can't really play.
Purity.
I'm forcing out what's in me into my instrument, even though I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm making this sound come out.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it stands up, because it's an honest bunch of music.
You know, there's one great song that's on here, obviously, is No Fun. I've seen a documentary about how you guys wrote that. It's kind of, supposedly it was based off of Johnny Cash's Walk the Line. Is that true, or is that not true? is that fake?
See, of course it is. It's one of Iggy's straight. It was first from Johnny Cash's. I came up with the riff.
Okay.
You know, I wrote the music. It's either, that's one of his things. It comes from Johnny. Every Stooges song came from Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line, or Ring of Fire, and the other one, and then I've heard this one too, all those songs from that first album came from a walk I took in Detroit where the factories, the machines are going, it's the factories. He just makes up stuff to interest his audience, to keep, you know, he's told so
going.
Many
sure.
fibs that he can't keep some of his stuff together.
So
it, people buy it, but that's not true. We just
really?
Created it. It was just sitting here at the, you know, being stoned and sitting in the band house and being a band and hanging out together and just playing, coming up with riffs and then going, hey, Jim, or he'd hear me playing and he'd go, I like that. Well, I won't, he'll listen to it and make a tape and write something for it. But all the titles were things that we actually said also, like No Fun, or She's Not Right, or We'll Have a Real Cool Time.
You know, so it's all just there,
Yeah, part of our band lingo, and he was smart enough to just take that stuff and turn it into lyrics.
Right on.
Because that was pretty much, we were living those lyrics.
Right on.
And we were a band in the days when we always did almost everything together.
Right.
It was rare that you didn't hang out with your dudes, man.
Right on.
You did everything except for, you know, take a dump and sleep, or even then sometime, but not have sex, of course. Or share your girlfriends. That was something that didn't really. But other than that, we were always together. We tripped together, ate food together, you know, we're coming down off acid.
And it's sad because a lot of people are driven apart. Everybody's so, like, you know, like, driven apart is not really much of a community.
Yeah, that's what's so different about Ann Arbor now, is every band really would help each other. It wasn't like competition.
Right.
Yeah, those guys are cool. They want to borrow an amp? Yeah, okay.
Mm.
Or you get us on a show? And everyone really helped each other. It was us against the establishment, so you take care of your bros, you know.
The way it should be. Scott Morgan, we were just talking about earlier. He's popped in here and stuff. With Scott Morgan, of course, he was in the Rational, Sonics, Rendezvous, and many other bands. And now you're doing a thing as well, a new thing coming out, and it's good to have both you guys down here, man. So,
yeah, man, stay in business.
Right on. So you guys must have played some shows together at certain points too, in separate bands.
We played with Rationals and Stooges played together. We played the Birmingham Palladium.
You guys aren't ready these gigs at all?
Well, I used to go ride with them sometimes when they did all the sock hops in Detroit.
Right.
And be terrified of Jeep Holland 95 miles an hour, 94. Yeah. And I was going to be, I almost took a ride home with the night that he rolled the van off the expressway.
My brother
rolled the van off the expressway.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And no one was really hurt, and the equipment was banged up a bit.
It's amazing.
But, he went off, and the van went, and I was almost in it. I probably would have been the guy that got killed if I rolled the van.
Oh, no.
It opened up like a sardine can.
Yep.
Really?
But wow. I used to go see those guys all the time as the Rationals. Because of hanging out, I got to see, like, 13th Floor Elevator, Richard and the Young Lions. They played all those great shows. All those bands that had records out there were popular because they had respect.
What was it like for you guys playing in bands back in Ann Arbor? What was the scene like for you guys and all that sort of thing? You know, I mean, obviously, you were saying before, like, oh, everybody's real supportive of each other and stuff. And what was
I just spoken about that. Yeah. Everyone's supportive and bands hanging out. It was the special club you hung out with.
There were a lot of space to have shows, and was this when, you know, the concerts were starting to happen in the parks?
The outdoor things, yeah.
Yeah, like
I mean, West Park.
Do you guys remember any of the lot of those good concerts stuff? Do you remember any particular stick out?
Well, what sticks out for me is it was a hot day at West Park, and the MC5 were playing, and they talked me into taking some acid. So I did, and then it's so hot, and I'm kind of miserable. And then Dennis Thompson goes, here, he gave me a 16-ounce bottle of ice-cold Stroh's beer. And I discovered beer and acid. And it was just wonderful.
Good combo.
Cold beer on a hot summer day on acid. And all of a sudden, hey, I was in heaven.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that sticks out for me a lot. They were fun. I mean, everyone was having a great time.
What was it like for you guys at the Granny Ballroom stuff? You guys all both like play some shows like the Granny Ballroom a lot and stuff. Like, what kind of scene was that for you guys? Obviously, that was like a lot of the lights and the sound and stuff.
I started going after I played there. I would just go by myself every Friday and Saturday night. Just take the family car and drive there myself. Take a little hit of speed, maybe a little Dexoxin, and go and just listen to the what was the band that had the song Time?
Chambers Brothers.
And they do like perfect speed, like an hour's version of Time. And just go in there to hang out, because that was a cool place to wear your flash clothes. You could either, you know, wear your hippie stuff or your English Beatles stuff. And it was, Grandy was home, so I always tried to go.
So after the...
What about him?
Yeah.
What do you think
about him? Yeah, come on, man. Get in this conversation.
Well, it's interesting that there's this MC5 movie, you know, that's coming out. And we went down, like, when they were first starting to make it, and actually went back to the Grandy. And there's holes in the ceiling now.
Back?
Yeah, there was a big piece of plywood over the front door, you know, where you go up the stairs in the front. And some church owns it now, and they've just kind of let it go.
I heard
there's
that.
It's just completely abandoned. Holes in the ceiling. It rains, snows in. Holes in the floor.
And I'm holding a piece of it in my
John
hand.
John has a piece in his hand of the Grandy Ballroom.
It was a beautiful place. My mother said she used to go dancing there
when
she was a younger.
The story that they always told us was that the big bands were louder than the bands with amplifiers.
That must have been something. It was a beautiful room.
Yeah, really. Yeah, it's sad. I've only seen it since the decadence of it all. But that was really like, I mean, where everybody hung out though.
It was,
really
was the cool spot. That's when I actually smoked marijuana with John Sinclair, Perry Bullard, the state representative, and a police lieutenant in uniform with gun. But backstage of the Grand, I'm with Sinclair and Perry Bullard smoking a joint. All of a sudden, cop walks in. I went, oh no, and Sinclair just hands him the joint. And he's taking big tokes off him. I thought for sure, I'm going to jail with John Sinclair.
Right, right.
So the cop was smoking?
Yep, cop was smoking dope.
Gotta love the Detroit Police Department.
Yeah. So about this time, this is when all that crazy stuff was going on. Sinclair's getting busted, the Panthers getting all crazy. Obviously, both of you guys were never really involved in like too heavy into politics. I mean, you're friends with these guys, but
exactly.
what was that whole scene like for you guys? It must have been kind of scary when all the FBI's creeping around your friend's house and stuff.
Well,
you know?
for me, it was it was cool, a place to go hang out, and I didn't, it was cool he was preaching good things, mm-hmm. but when it got to the thing about violence, that was like, no way, man, it's right. a little too scary.
Even though there
but
was
mostly going there for the chicks,
right.
there were always women there, right. and I'd always go and smoke drugs and talk to the band. Right. I like hanging out with Rob Tyner and, right. and watching him draw cartoons. Even more when the other guys are upstairs passing the rocket reducer around. I'd be downstairs watching Rob work on cartoons at his easel.
Wow.
And then they had great round table meetings. Well, actually, it was a long table, like a knight's table, uh-huh. where you could sit like 30, 40 people. Mm-hmm. And they just talk every mm-hmm. night.
For people that don't know, we're talking about the 1510 and 1520 mm-hmm. Hill Street. Which is now, I think, Luther Co-op, and so that's the
Stooges Wax.
It's the Stooges Wax. Yeah. And you have no clue how many people have come here looking for that.
And I've got yeah. calls, and some of that lived there actually told me as recent as somebody I know knows somebody that lived there, mm-hmm. and they were still getting mail as of like a couple years ago.
Sure, sure.
And I've had people call up from Europe. People came from Europe to go
I've
to
heard these
Stooges
stories.
Wax.
Yes, I know. Yeah, just give a little background for the Motor Booty magazine at one point had published an article saying that it was a wax museum here in Ann Arbor at this house we're talking about. But with photos, yeah, there was the actual jar of peanut butter from the Cincinnati Pop Festival yeah. show that smeared out itself, the wax figure, and if anybody's listening out there, don't come to Ann Arbor. It really doesn't exist. It's a bunch of kids living in the house, and they probably don't have anything good to smoke. But anyway,
ain't no wax museum.
It was that. So, but the Ann Arbor back then, though, is it's real happening and stuff. But then you've got this real crazy environment of all this like real heavy politics stuff, and a lot of violence going on the streets, and with the Southview riots, it's like that.
Well, we lived right by. We mm-hmm. were on Forest Court then.
Oh, really?
I was actually. It was just a walk around the corner.
Yeah. Right.
The Forest Courthouse. Mm-hmm. And the first night, it was cool. People mm-hmm. just hanging out and stuff. But the next night, when the police were ready, mm-hmm. I'm going, oh my, this is ugly. I'm not going to... And then I was at the old Whistle Stop restaurant, mm-hmm. and some dude started chucking bricks at the cops. So you just tear gas. And, you know, mm-hmm. if you ever been, even not directly tear gas, but
have.
A good whiff of it, mm-hmm. it's bad. Mm-hmm. So people were running to hide in our house. No, wait a minute, come on.
With the cops chasing in your front door.
People are running down there, and they go, they're little Stooges, the guys that sell the dope living.
Yeah.
Get out of here. But it was fun, though, like I said. Yeah. It was a us against them kind of feeling, and uh-huh. everyone was into helping each other and sharing.
Right.
It was good. I wouldn't change time periods for anything. They were wonderful times.
Yeah, overall, I mean, the Stooges and the Rationals, neither were really very political, but everybody, everybody was opposed to the war, everybody was into, like, all the new stuff.
Nobody wanted to get drafted and die, yeah.
Integration and, you know, drugs and, you know, the sex and, you know, I mean, free love and, you know, everything that the hippies brought to the table, like, you know, was cool. So we were political, but we weren't organized like that.
So about this time, you guys started working on your second album, just to jump into the next thing here. You started working on the Funhouse album. You started working on the material for that after doing a lot of touring in this time period.
Well, that we learned to play. They put us on the road after the first album.
Wow.
And we continually, constantly played. And that's how we worked up that set in between, have a little time off, come up with a piece of music, uh-huh. develop it. And that whole album was actually written while playing on the road mostly.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the concept that Don Gallucci wanted, was to capture that. Which was cool because we were so well rehearsed, we actually came off touring and right in the studio. And there's the...
Yeah, the box that the box that I've said of pulling. This is something I wanted to bring up with you. Now, it says on the box that you may not have really heard this or not, but the A side, whatever, the organ solo that's down the street, whatever stuff.
Ben Edmonds.
How did you feel about that? Because obviously you guys were just you put this really good record together, and also the company decides to come in and like.
We didn't know about it.
Organ.
I did not know about it until Ben Edmonds told me. Uh-huh. Because he had gotten an advanced copy of the box set on cassette tape.
Okay.
And he goes, well, what's up with that? And I'm going, I figured out they were trying to see what it would sound like if we were the heavy metal Doors or something. The punky Doors.
Was that a kind of annoying thing for you?
I thought it was funny. It was. I didn't even know about it until like last year.
But at the time, though, did you feel like there was, because I don't, like there was like some mention in the box that while you're recording Funhouse, there was a two-way mirror supposedly in front of the Doors.
Danny Sugarman told me that story that
Jim
Morrison came in one night and checked out the band while we were recording.
Right.
So I always say when I tell the story, of course, we're standing at the mirror, you know, looking at our hair, scratching whiteheads off our face, checking our nose for boogers and stuff. And he's supposedly Jim Morrison. That's what Sugarman said.
Right.
That he was there.
Some stuff there from the Funhouse album. You guys went to L.A., recorded the Funhouse. And
first time in L.A.
Right.
It was.
Good time.
Oh, the very first day I was there, I love movies, so we're right there in Hollywood at the good old Tropicana where the Doors actually had, their offices were at the Trop.
Right.
And the great Duke's Diner, all these classic things. So I got a little stoned and I thought I'd take a walkabout. So I'm crossing the street and I have the light, I'm crossing, but I'm like, wow, I'm in Hollywood.
Right.
And a car, a limousine, slams on its brakes and misses me by 3 feet.
Right.
And the back window rolls down and I hear this familiar voice go, "You blanking asshole." Oh, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
And I'm going, "It's John Wayne." I'm going, "John Wayne called me an effing a-hole." Yay! First day in Hollywood, John Wayne called me an effing a-hole.
Must be doing something right.
Well, apparently he must have, when he hit the brakes, he didn't wear seatbelts, he must have spilled his drink all
over. Yeah. Chris from Maldahead. So you guys came back from L.A. then, and you came back here, and things kind of started changing around here. Like Detroit started getting kind of weird, and the band started getting into some
stuff. The bad drugs were coming in.
Right.
And drugs were becoming serious business, and drugs got ugly.
Can I ask you something real fast here, too? Like, because a lot of times people really glorify a lot of that crap, and I know that a lot of times people may even look up to, like, 80... as far as somebody that was really glorified, and I know on a personal level, I mean, that, you know, like, drugs really affected you in a lot of ways. Like, I mean, to the kids out there that think that kind of stuff is cool, I mean, we're not talking about smoking pot and that whole thing. We're talking about the serious crap. I mean, how would you say that?
I lost...
Not that we want to make a community speech,
well,
or, you know.
I know, but I lost everything I owned, and I saw my good friends, some die, and saw the end of a band that I loved disintegrate. And it's terrible. I mean, the bad heroin, pills, hard drugs, it really see somebody you love, either see them die or slowly see them about to die. It's not cool. It's totally not cool. It takes away all the creative fun. It makes life unfun. You don't have fun when you have to depend on something other than food, air, and water to keep you going, to have do what you have to do and have a good time.
So this pretty much came in between, like, the band and the music adventure, too. I know you guys eventually, like, the infamous story down at the Washington Bridge, everybody crashed the truck into the bridge.
Well, it was my brother driving on Reds.
The Washington Street Bridge down by the Blind Pig we're talking about here,
Well, we rented this truck, and stipulation was, of course, no one can drive it, but the guy, he got it from his father's rent-a-truck place. And those guys, I'm going, well, why would you take Reds and drive to the show and then play?
Right.
So my brother wanted to drive. He had no license. And they went under the bridge and didn't make it.
So that pretty much was like you guys destroyed their stuff. Now it's kind of like the end for a while.
Well, the equipment wasn't hurt, but the truck was totaled.
Right.
We missed the show that night at the Easttown Theater. It was a Friday night. We did play on Saturday, but my brother was injured too badly to play, so we used Steve McKay on drums.
Wow.
So that afternoon, Steve came over with not a drum set. We had no drum set. He would just, you know, tap out. As I played the tunes with the little practice amp, he'd just tap them out on his legs, you know.
Right, right.
So when he actually got on stage to play, he freaked. His arms become, you know, when you ever played the drums and you're stiff or you're stiff enough, he just could not coordinate. And then they put the spotlight right on him. His face is beet red. And it's just the very first 10, you know, 8 bars into the first song, it's totally floundering. And he goes back and goes, 1, 2, 3. And everybody goes, stop, Steve. Everybody stop. Oh, my God. And then he goes, 1, 2. So we did like three songs.
Right.
But poor Steve was so red-faced and embarrassed,
right,
he wouldn't accept his pay. We made him take it. We made him take his money. Take it.
So we got like a short amount of time. Besides, I want to talk about all the other stuff you've done besides the Stooges there. But you guys have kind of a breakup at one point, and then things kind of fell apart.
Well,
and it transferred onto a whole different thing.
After
a lot of people already know this, so maybe we'll give a short.
After Funhouse, it went on to Raw Power. What happened? Iggy just once again had to quit playing to clean up his act.
Right.
So he roamed around. He happened to be in New York, bumming around to try to get something going. When he ran into David Bowie, who was supposedly a fan of his, Bowie took him to meet Tony DeFries. They had lunch. Right. Tony signed him. The next day, he took them to CBS to Clive Davies, got him a deal with CBS Columbia, and then they went on to England.
Right.
And I didn't even know any of this was happening until I ran into Iggy at a party at Morgan Sound on Morgan Road, the old SRC studio.
Mm-hmm.
He just casually comes up to me and goes, "Oh, by the way, I got a record deal, and James and I are going to England next week."
Mm-hmm.
Bye!
Right.
But
then, of course, 3 months later...
Well, he calls up 3 months later, going, "Well, we auditioned 100 bass players and drummers, and no one's good enough, so do you want to play?"
Right.
Well, half they exhausted everything they could think of.
Right.
Sent for the two bombs. Yeah.
So you guys went over and you did the sessions for...
And it was fun. Got to stay for 9 months. Uh-huh. Rehearsed, did that.
And you moved over to bass at this point. This is kind of a change for you.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Well, the idea was I'd go back eventually, but they couldn't find a bass player. And I always enjoyed playing bass, and Iggy liked my bass playing.
Right.
So I'm going, yeah, I'll do that for a while. And I'm glad I did. I got to do it and get it documented. If you can hear it on the record.
Yeah, right. Of course.
At times, if you can quite hear it.
Right. How do you, and real briefly, too, I mean, how do you feel with the mix in there? Because obviously that's been a big... point of
controversy. The first time we heard the mix in L.A., we all hated it. And Iggy just says, "Well, it's this or another 6 months, so it's this." We always, you know, there's no drums. The drums got messed with.
Uh-huh.
A bass, you know, plenty of guitar and vocals. But as Don Fleming said, the producer and used to be in the band Gumball, he goes, "Just wait till you hear that Iggy mix of Raw Power. You'll be going, boy, I love that Bowie mix of Raw Power." So...
a few more shows. And
well, actually, it was fun being in England for 9 months. Had a great time. Also, having Angie Bowie help me spend some of David's money on expensive restaurants and nightclubbing. And we wound up coming back to Ann Arbor to wait to go to L.A. And once we got to L.A., they just put us up, my brother and myself, at the Hyatt House, the Riot House on Sunset Strip. They pretty much kept us under wraps, but we rehearsed. We only played one show in England, the King's Cross Cinema,
mm-hmm.
and
which
that was one
show
at the
Ford
Auditorium in Detroit.
And that's supposed to be the one show in England, too, is like a pretty infamous show for a lot of people that were pretty influenced by the whole show and gone on to...
I didn't realize those many the people, the musicians that were there that night or anything.
Well, I don't think they were even all that musicians
yet,
really.
Well, yeah, sorry, they weren't them.
Right. How does that make you feel, though? When you, I mean, because obviously a lot of that... You know, like the whole punk rock thing and stuff, and a lot, even to what's going on today, is all from a credit to your work and stuff. How does it make you feel?
Poor.
No, besides the monetary reason.
No, it does make me feel really good, and I'm glad that I got to do that, and that's great. It really is a satisfying feeling.
But does it make you? I mean, does it make you bitter though, in a way?
No.
Or does it make you? I mean, how do you? You know, do you think in the end it'll all right itself?
Yeah.
Like 200 years down the road, like Shakespeare was. Well, if it's any copper, I think like Shakespeare never had a single thing.
Well,
covered.
I just don't want to be Van Gogh.
Right.
Sold one painting his whole life, then when he dies, his paintings go for $60 million.
Right.
Well,
right.
Other than that monetary aspect, exactly.
Right.
But finally, people like Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr., the Monster Magnet dudes, they're starting to come out and offer some playing and some help, and maybe we can do this and we can do that, because you were one of my guitar heroes, and they always mention my name in their interviews and stuff. So,
what did you start thinking when the Sex Pistols was first coming out and stuff, and that whole thing? And they were like, you know, I mean, you know, they're attributing a lot of this to you guys and that whole thing, the cover and Stooges songs. And that's
I say rock on, because if they get going and they say stuff, it always helps other people and drags along the old guys, like the English rock stars did with the old blues musicians and the old rock musicians, maybe bringing Chuck Berry back. Especially the old blues guys with the Yardbirds and stuff, and giving them a second shot around, which is very cool.
Mm-hmm. So after the Stooges finally broke up, you went on to do some other work for a while. You first started out with New Order, is that correct?
I stayed in L.A. after Iggy quit for the third or fourth time,
right,
and got Dennis Thompson out there, and we started the band The New Order, but we picked the wrong place. Well, not the band, actually kind of the wrong place also at the wrong time. Mm-hmm. It was all into disco.
Mm-hmm.
And that hard rock stuff,
sure,
no one was buying it.
It's kind of like now with the techno thing, right?
So we were in the wrong time period once again.
Right.
Ahead or behind seems
right
to be my problem.
Right.
Either ahead or behind, I can't quite get in the groove. And we just ran that in the ground. Nobody wanted it. So we actually had I found out from Kim Fowley we had a possible deal, but the record company didn't like the guy who said he was our manager, and he wasn't really. And we had problems with the singer taking drugs once again, Quaaludes and Angel Dust.
Rock and roll.
And blowing a big show where booking agents and Mercury Records were there to see us. But he blew that for us, and finally it just disintegrated and guys went away.
So
then I came back to Michigan,
mm-hmm,
and I found this guy kept bugging me to jam with him, and it turned out to be a guy who was in Destroy All Monsters.
Kerry Lauren was his name?
Yes, okay. And I met Niagara, and then that band was more of a freeform kind of noise and weird band, and I said, well, if I'm going to be in it, I want to be a rock band. Michael Davis just got out of jail, yay. So I got Michael to play bass,
uh-huh,
and got Rob King, who's a good and great rock drummer,
mm-hmm,
and turned it into the more contemporary rock.
Because more of you are probably familiar with the newer version of Destroy All Monsters. You had a couple of singles out at the time and stuff, but now people are starting to know a little more about the early Destroy All Monsters also and stuff. So it's kind of weird, like, you know, when you look at the two bands, they're kind of, I mean, even though there's somewhat of a similar,
They used to play, the early ones was Mike Kelly, who became the performance artist and painter, mm-hmm, you know Mike Kelly.
Of course.
That's why they're being known again, because he's very popular.
Right.
But they just played parties. They never really played.
Right.
They were a noise band that just got together a bunch of art students to have some extra fun. They
mm-hmm
couldn't really play.
Mm-hmm.
So he's out now doing stuff, I guess. He does it in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going, not the rock version, but
their
version is like.
So Destroy All Monsters was around for a while. You guys,
a long time actually. 19, pretty much rocking from 70, late 77, 78.
Uh-huh.
Finally broke up in 85 when I did a motion picture, The Carrier.
Where's Scott? I want to get
Scott.
He's
in the bathroom.
Is he back? Because I want to get him talking about Dave Chance.
Tell us about movies.
Well, that's what broke up the Destroy All Monsters.
Really?
Is I got into this movie thing. I auditioned for this part,
right,
and I was gone for 3 months,
uh-huh,
and everyone kind of got mad at me.
Uh-huh.
And, I came back, and everyone had kind of dispersed.
Right.
So that went on to the next phase,
which was
Niagara had done this Dark Carnival thing, which was just a specialty band.
Uh-huh.
They just do a couple, three, four shows a year,
uh-huh,
and that became a regular band.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the next phase. Finally, they bugged me to play, and I said, well, I'll do it if you make it more regular. I'm going to try to do something with this.
Mm-hmm.
And we did, and that, once again,
mm-hmm,
that didn't really take off. And
right,
now you're hearing, now that it's gone, people are starting to listen, maybe care a little bit more. Now that it's gone.
Now the word is out there.
Well,
right?
Like Phil from Monster Magnet says, people are starting to get into Destroy All Monsters, the rock version, mm-hmm, now more.
Mm-hmm.
Scott
Moore is back.
He wants to talk to you.
Yeah, we wanted to talk real fast. We were just talking about Destroy All Monsters, and we were talking about back in the day, because you're in Sonic's Rendezvous.
We used to play with
at
them.
At the same time. You guys
would open up a lot of
times. Second Chance a lot together. What were those days like for you guys all together and stuff, you know? Quite some fun nights.
Oh, yeah, I mean, the music was good. We never really made any money, at least not the Sonic Rendezvous.
That's what it was about, right? Obviously.
No,
yeah.
It was about the music.
Yeah.
We were, Sonic Rendezvous band was, when I looked at the videos, we were like shoegazers, basically.
Really?
Watching the Stooges or the Five or even the Rationals, and we just sort of stood there and played. It was like we were in a studio or something.
That's amazing, because it's so high energy, too. You'd expect to be flying around, like, the headband ahead and
well,
stuff.
Well, if we didn't open up for them, I'd always go and see him play.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Because it was a favorite, of course, one of my favorite guys were ever. A bro.
Uh-huh.
And it was a great band.
Right on.
I still sing some of the songs in the shower.
There you go. There you go. There's a rumor that you guys both shared a practice space at one point over at the Big City Bakery. Is that a rumor or is that not true? I'm trying to get all the myths dispersed tonight.
Oh, you mean on Miller?
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the Cult Heroes thing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, that's what it was. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
But I used to go and hang out there.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I heard a rumor that you guys had all...
It was a nice place. Yeah, they had that... Well, actually, we Destroy All Monsters rehearsed in their stage. They had that stage downstairs, and they lived upstairs on Miller and Spring.
Yeah, oh, okay.
Well, yeah,
that's what it was.
Yeah, oh, it was a great rehearsal space.
Really? I don't think the neighbors liked it.
Those guys, the Knights didn't like the rowdy dudes.
Uh-huh.
So, boing.
Right, right. What was it? So Ann Arbor at that point, it's like late 70s, punk had broken, you guys were doing your things. What was it like, though? Because I know there was, I've heard, like, different interviews before, so there's, like, a lot of folk music was going on. And
seemed like things were kind of starting to fall apart. People were starting to drift away.
Uh-huh.
To go to L.A. or go to other towns.
Uh-huh.
At least the crowd I hung in, or they just get so absorbed into Ann Arbor, they disappear.
Yeah.
You know how you tend to get absorbed into Ann Arbor. Whatever happened to him? Well, I saw him. He's walking down on Washington Street 2 years ago. And then 5 years later, yeah, there he is. Oh, he's in a cab. He's driving a cab.
Yeah.
A lot of times I've seen a lot of old friends. They're cab drivers.
Yeah, amazing.
The scene
like
I remember was that it was like the Second Chance, at least, was like cover bands.
Right.
And they would come in, they'd play Thursday through Sunday, and they'd make all the money.
That's right.
They made like $2,000.
Kind of like,
it's true. Toby Red, Muggsy. I mean, they'd
Toby Red, which is Chad Smith's band. Chad Smith in is the drummer for
Pete Bankard being in
Chili Peppers now.
Yeah.
Oh,
Pete,
really?
Yeah, Pete Bankard being in Muggsy. They make like, Pete's going, yeah, you know, I was making like $1,000 a week, man. I'm like, what? I'd be making $100 a month, man.
And, you know, and probably Stooges, but I know Sonic Carnival Band, we'd be like, we make $200, like, you know, on a Tuesday or something like that.
Well, I got, while we get up, Carver would give us a Monday night, and usually we'd go overboard with opening acts, and PAs sometimes would be very expensive. So we'd make some money, but after doling out the, you know, $350 to the PA, paying your roadies, whatever, paying the opening band $100 a piece or whatever, you know, you wind up with a couple $100.
So you guys were like, you guys weren't even like doing this like big, amazing, like you guys are huge or something. You were just kind of like basically
surviving.
Monday, Tuesday nights, surviving.
It paid the rent in my apartment.
That's pretty amazing.
Kept me in beer and cigarettes.
You guys have both been in bands, you know, at early points and then later points is also where it's been, now it's being discovered or whatever and stuff. I mean, by the time that you would think that, like, you know, guys like us, you know, we're in our 30s, whatever, you know, or you're young, 20s to 30s, so we hear it now, we're like, God, it must have been, like, fucking huge back then and stuff. And, you know, obviously, but you're telling me now that you guys were playing Monday, Tuesday nights.
Yeah.
Wow.
No respect.
Muggsy gets Friday and Saturday nights.
Something's never changed.
You guys sound familiar. Friday and Saturday
never changed.
Sunday night or something like that.
Well, Pete's going, yeah, I'm making $1,000 this weekend.
And where's Muggsy now?
Yeah. Well, they were playing covers. Mm. You're playing with exactly what was on the radio at the time.
Yep.
Kind of like now.
We were doing original tunes. And,
you know, they would throw in a couple originals, you know, just so they could say that they were a real band, you know. But
kind of like now.
You know, they weren't that great. And they sounded like the covers. And,
right.
You know,
so they do weddings and bar mitzvahs now?
I don't know where they are now.
So why I've got two musicians through, and again, you know, I hate saying it in front of you guys and all, but I got two musicians in this room that have had the strongest integrity of any musician I've met, you know, in my entire lifetime. Neither one of you guys have ever sold out at all, in any extreme at all. You've both been true to your form. Even now, you're still doing something that's true to heart.
I'll use Wayne Kramer's line.
Right.
I put it in a song, but we tried to sell out. Nobody was buying. Nobody was buying.
Yeah.
Hey, I jam with the Backstreet Boys now if they pay me, man.
Yeah. But still, though, I mean, even a lot of times, I mean, you could have changed the whole thing. I mean, like, obviously, you still kept to you know, some of the original form. You've never gone overboard and tried to cut off your past, to deny your past, and just go bubblegum.
Can't do it.
Mm.
It goes against the grain for me.
Yeah, right. It's just like that robot in Forbidden Planet. It's built in. I'll self-destruct if I go against my orders. What's inside of me.
Beautiful thing, man. Beautiful thing. Let's hear a project right now real fast. This is New Race. This is something you did with someone you worked with before, obviously.
Dennis Tech sat in with
the Rendezvous Band reunion, the Majestic, couple years ago.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Dennis Townsend played with us when we did Dodge Main a few years ago.
Dennis Townsend, yep. And
two of my favorites.
That was an amazing show. I mean, down Novi, Yeah.
The library.
Love that
never
show.
Been the same since.
Love that
never
show.
Never will be again either.
So you did Dennis Tucker, who was in Radio Perman, you did a project with him and a couple of guys from that and Thompson, race.
He asked for my brother, but my brother didn't go, so Thompson was glad to go. Mm-hmm. Thompson and I went down under, and it was Dennis Tech, Rob Younger, and Warwick Gilbert who played bass.
Right on.
And then Chris Maswak would come and do a couple shows, and Pip Hoyle, who played keyboards, when he wasn't a doctor, and he was a doctor also down there,
uh-huh.
he would come and do a couple shows.
Wow.
So I had a great time. Love Australia. If you can go, go. It's great.
Well, again, thanks for coming down.
My pleasure.
And we're also now going to talk about some of the stuff you've done recently. Now, we're going to play a couple things coming up here. One thing, you were involved in the Wild Rats for the Velvet Goldmine movie. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about that for a little bit?
Well, I got a call from Don Fleming. He had produced a Dark Carnival CD. And he goes, well, gee, I put together this band. I got this job to do like a Stooge-type band for this movie, Velvet Goldmine. I've got Mike Watt, and I've got Thurston Moore and Steve Shelley. We were looking for a Ron Ashton-type guitar player. And then he went, duh, why don't I ask Ron? He's not doing anything. So the powers that be said it was cool. So I went and did a couple songs for the record. But in the meantime, he took good advantage of the time. And we did them. Just ran tape on a bunch of stuff. And I liked the lineup so well, I kept saying, you got to bug the record company to, let's make a record. Mm-hmm. So sure enough, a year later, we went back and did a whole album's worth of stuff. With the same lineup of guys, plus Sean Lennon, John Lennon's son. He played some electronics.
Mm-hmm.
He did some jams. So we filled up 52 reels of tape.
Right on.
So there's enough to make 3 records.
So you think we'll see this come later?
Well, supposedly... Yeah. This is going to come out on Thurston Moore's label, Static Piece.
Static Piece, right on.
And was waiting any time. I mean, he's been so busy. Apparently, it's in the process of getting put together.
How did you feel with the Velvet Goldmine? Because I know a lot of people were kind of like, were hoping it was going to be more of a Stooges story, maybe a little more realistic, and it's kind of like a whole fantasy thing.
Well, that's what Todd Haynes wanted, and that's the kind of stuff Todd directs. But I thought he chose well in the cast, and there were moments that were... frightfully close to reality.
Okay.
We're seeing the actress like who played supposedly Angie Bowie. A lot of those things actually did happen.
Really?
Of course, he had to throw it in fantasy, not to get sued or whatever. So,
right on.
I liked it. I went and saw it at Tribeca Studios, which is Robert De Niro and Scorsese.
Oh, really?
Private, big, huge chairs. And I'm sitting next to this guy, and I'm going, gee, I don't want to sit next to anybody. I want to watch this by myself. So I get up and move from this guy, and he kind of looks at me like, hey, dude. It was Mark from the, what's that band?
Mike D. Beastie Boys.
From the Beastie Boys.
Mike D.
Geez, sorry, man. But you run it? Did I stink or something? He got up and moved away from me. So I'm like, I said, no, I didn't. I didn't know who you were, and I just like to see them be by myself. And it's because Mike Watts right behind me goes, hey, that didn't happen. So I go, can I wait a while a little bit, too?
So we got some of this Wild Rats, but I want to talk one thing also. You also did some movies at some point. I want to bring you back another time.
Yeah.
Just so people know, if they see it on TV, that you're in...
Oh, Mosquito.
Mosquito.
They show it on USA at the late night of the Saturday afternoon movies.
Right.
Gunner, you see, get my name in the TV, guy?
Right. I've seen it, actually. Yeah.
So Leatherface and Stooge.
Right.
So that's our joke. I talk to Gunner all the time.
So if you ever see Mosquito on TV, like sit down and watch it. It also has Mike Hart in the
Yeah, Mike Hart's in it.
Kenny
Mungwamp's in it, too.
Right on.
And Margaret from the Dollar Rocks
is naked in it.
I didn't realize that until she told me that the other day. I didn't know about that. Thanks, Scott Morgan, for coming in.
Yeah.
Stay with us. He's on his way out the door here. I think he's going out for a stiff one.
He's going out for a splash.
Yeah, and I think I might be down there in a couple minutes at the watering hole myself, so save me some grass there. And I'd also like to thank Dara, because Dara really helped a lot with hooking us up.
Dara.
You mean Dara?
Dara. I don't know your damn name. I just work with you.
Dara.
Sorry. Just don't call me Ron Safari, I guess. So and everybody else from the studio for hanging out and keeping things in orderly fashion and stuff. But most of all, I'd like to thank Ron, one of my biggest heroes and a great guest.
Thank you. I had a good time, and like I said, I'll be back when I come back from Texas.
Yeah.
I'll bring you the biggest cowboy hat, the biggest steak you've ever seen in your life.
That's right. Give us the stories. You're going down to South by Southwest.
Yeah,
to deal.
Play with Jay Mascis and the Fog. I'm in.
And Mike Watt.
Right on. And Mike Watt.
Featuring Mike Watt.
So you go down, are you doing that show? Are you doing any other stuff down south?
But hopefully something good will come of it. I might go on tour and play more shows with them.
Right.
And hopefully hook something up so I can get out there.
Because you just did this thing, like, you know, refresh people's memory. You did this thing at the Pig a few months back there where you did the J Masters came to town with Mike Watt and all that, and then you came and stepped in for some songs, mm-hmm. and it was really shredding. It was a great time. And so you formed a little coalition again after this. Say, it's so much fun. Let's go do this full time.
And they called me up. I said, hey, anytime you want to play. And I blew the call up and says, how would you like to come to Texas? Watt calls me up.
Okay. Well, shit, man. Sounds good, man.
Okay, so things get a popping, get on the road again, and I'll be back.
The way it should be. Well, good luck in Texas.
All right, thank you.
And like I said, come on back when you're back and give us the lowdown.
Tell you some stories.
And once again, thank you so much, man. It's been my pleasure.
Had a
great
time,
man. It's really great to have you down.
Thank you, John.
Ladies and gentlemen, Ron Ashton, ladies and gentlemen.
Good night, and I'm
up. Yeah.
Watt for Pedro show. That was John Griffin interviewing Ron Ashton. February 27, 2001, WCBN, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Thanks again, John. And miss you much, Ronnie. Next week I'm going to be playing your bass parts. It's the end of the second hour, October 31, 2009, Watt for Pedro show. Hold tight for hour three. October 31st, 2009. Happy Halloween. It's the third hour of the Watt from Pedro show.
Into a mouth, the sex you work, back to Dick. And someday we'll smile. Whoa, I will, and he will. But that ain't gonna bend you down and tie your waking suit. Stand there broken like an open core in the sun. A trembling and sizzling in the noonday sun. Wondering if you got the time to get clean. An empty-headed, handed boy. Pocket and shoes. A dirty blue jean is aching. Ha 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 to lose. Don't you wish you never met her? Oh, a dirty blue jean. Open cold in the sun. Your back is aching, man, and your wait is never done. Don't you wish you never met her? Dirty blue jean. Don't you wish you never met her?
Come on.
Watt from Pedro show. Start off the third hour with Flatter by Sandy Yang. Played with Tom Watson. Tom Watson had a band with her called The Best of Everything, or Best of All, or something. Sorry, I can't remember right. But she also played with Tom in the Red Crayola. She's on a couple Red Crayola albums. And then we heard a couple songs from Captain Beefheart. This is from a re-released bootleg. I don't know, better tapes were found, better ways of making things sound better. But the Shiny Beast stuff and all that. And there's two early versions. There's a great song on Doc at the Raider Station called Dirty Blue Jean. And I had an earlier instrumental version from some compilation thing. But here's two other ones. And in fact, one of these has some things that are very close to the one that, you know, made a, what do you say, legitimate release. But you can hear words in both of these. And you hear words, too, that weren't in the final version. But that's a great song. I got to do a version of that with Nels Klein. Michael Preusner is very difficult. It's on some Beefheart tribute record. I can't remember the name of it. Maybe it's a title of one of his songs or something. But I did it during the Ball Hugger Tugboat sessions. Man, that was a tough song to learn. But we got it. Well, Nels Klein, he can learn everything. Anything.
Yeah.
Everything. I get to play with him again in end of the year in Tokyo. And then make a second brother, sister, daughter album with him. After Beefheart, we heard Recession War Blues by Charlie Noakes, who's a bass player from England. But there's him doing some blues, and everybody knows that's what big part of, no matter how weird Beefheart is, it's all about the blues. Yeah. And then we heard The Roof Blew Off, Open Up, by the Coen Brothers, another band from England. Yeah, play tonight with Pete and Jer, and then again Monday, opening up for Shonen Knife, which is a lady band from Japan. Came over early in the late 80s, first time, one of the first bands from over there, from their punk scene. And Echo Park, the Echo, I think, which used to be Nayard. I think it still says Nayard on the outside. It was like a Guatemalan dance club, nightclub. I played a benefit there once when it was still called Nayard.
Is that on Sunset or?
And yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But not the Hollywood part, way east in Echo Park. And then I go away. I go to Sao Paulo. Like I was saying at the end of that interview there. First gig for this new lineup of Iggy and the Stooges, James Williamson, and of course, Scotty Sound on drums, Brother Steve on the sax. And we just had some more practices. And we're going to try it out November 7th in Sao Paulo, something called Planeta Terra Festival. And I think what you were seeing was a listing for May 2nd and 3rd for playing All A Raw Power in London at Barry Hogan's Altamar Party Don't Look Back series. Okay. Yeah.
Because your Who page breaks it down by your projects.
Yeah, but that's not until May.
I got you.
And there's probably gigs before that.
Yeah. Have you played Brazil before?
Yeah, with Stooges.
Yeah.
And another band on the bill is Sonic Youth. All and right. Sonic Youth was on that gig a couple years ago, too.
Yeah.
So Lee's coming back. He just did 3 or 4 gigs with them, but he had broken his wrist, and they had to postpone a lot of gigs.
Yeah.
I remember Thurston had a book with the tunings in it. Yeah. I saw him at the Anti-Club, yeah. They don't do like Nels where you just move the fingers. They actually tune the guitars different. So they needed them. And some of them different kinds of string setups. And remember, one of them only had like 4. It wasn't a bass. It was a guitar. And then there was a space, 2 strings, a space, and 2 strings. And there's a screwdriver in there and beating with a drumstick. They were so... I remember seeing them and I told D. Boone, because I thought Minutemen was trying some adventure stuff, and I said, man, these guys make us look like Chuck Berry. I thought it was so wild, you know. And then I get to meet Thurston and talking to him about Richard Hell. He saw the Voidoids a bunch of times, and, you know, I never got to seeing him. And it's just all kinds. Thurston's a music guy, man. An art guy and just everything. Very yeah. interesting person. Yeah, great man. What about the Blue Oyster Cult?
I just love
You had your book with your pictures. You put them away.
Yeah, well.
You got pictures from... They played in 1980 at the Dancing Waters as Soft White Underbelly, which was a name they had before Blue Oyster Cult. But it wasn't their first name. Stock Forest Group was an early name, but I think they even had a name before that. Yeah. But, and did you take those yourself?
Yeah,
me and D. Boone were at that gig. So were a lot of the Black Flag guys.
Sorry, here.
I hadn't seen him for years, maybe 4 or 5 years, and saw him again. It was like, whoa. Now,
these are some pictures of a gig that you were at, which was the Brain Surgeons at the Coconut Teaser. Unfortunately, I didn't get you in there.
Well, that's not Dancing Waters.
But
it's not even called the Teaser anymore. I don't know what it's called.
You remember when Albert would take his sticks and he'd come through the audience playing on everybody's bill pay bottles. Yeah, entertaining, you know. But
I can't remember... I don't think there was any tables up for BOC and Dancing Waters.
Yeah.
I remember he had a blinky bow tie on.
Yeah, that's what you were saying.
And when I said that to him, because I got to be friends with him years later, and I didn't know it at the time, but he was drumming at that gig. Because he had left, and then they brought him back, I guess, for that tour.
I got all sorts of stuff in this book. You know, I've talked about Bola before and him and his...
Bola is the guy who ran the fan club. Does he still do that?
No, he's kind of passed the reins over to a fellow named Ralph that does the Hot Rails to Hull website.com. But I thought you might think these were interesting. Bola and his ex-wife, Melanie.
Yeah, I know Morning Final. That's a song on Agents of Fortune.
Well, they actually, this was the name of their little publication to keep in with the fans. You know, I picked up a business card, said BOC fans, and this is back in the early 90s. I was at one of their gigs at the Strand in Redondo.
Yeah, but Morning Final still, in the 70s.
But that's a song. No, these are little booklets that he and his wife would Xerox. They named the name of their little magazine to keep in touch with the fans. You'd sign up and they'd mail you their little Xerox magazines. This is before the internet.
Well, did you get the lyrics?
Oh, yeah.
In the old days in the 70s, they'd be on this computer paper, green and white striped stuff.
Well, now, Bola actually went extensively.
Oh, yeah, but this is not... What happened was they'd lyrics on the album covers. Yeah. You'd send in and this printout would come.
Yeah.
And they weren't in lines.
Yeah.
It was just...
Yeah.
They'd go to the margin, go to the next, go to the margin.
I did not mail away.
It was like a teletype. Yeah, I had them. I don't have them now like an idiot, but I had them. Because it's very hard to tell what they were singing.
Especially the first album.
Well, any of them. Like the Mummy's Inscription in the Batwing Tongue. I mean, once you read that, okay. But if you've never read it before, you can't believe that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, Transmaniacon MC has all these... The manager wrote a lot of the lyrics, and they just pushed them in there. Richard, when Meltzer wrote for him, he would write smaller words. But Perlman had no idea, or maybe it was to just give him a tough chore to do, because these multi-syllable words, you know, crazy.
Yeah, well, it was his concept, like, who was the guy behind the Sex Pistols? He had it all planned out for
Malcolm McLaren.
Yeah, McLaren, yeah. And Sandy, you know, before he even met half the guys, he just had this idea, you know.
He went to school with them.
Yeah, yeah. Stony
Meltzer
Brook.
Meltzer, too. Yeah, Long Stony Brook. Island. S-U-N-Y.
Yeah.
Yeah, here's some more music.
exclusions, no one comes for free. I don't respond to you, you don't respond to me. But love's trapped us in, nothing sets us free.
she made an album too.
Yeah.
And she's friend of the band and she's stuff.
A girlfriend of one of them. It was Albert. Yeah. For a little while.
Some kind of New York scene of
early rock. On. And they liked her writing a lot. She flowed them a few, as you say, I'm quoting you now all the time, a few songs.
The only one I know is Tattoo Love Vampire or something.
Yeah.
It's on Agents of Fortune.
Yeah.
But there's a couple songs with Patti Smith.
Yeah.
The Vera Gemini. Revenge Albert did. Yeah.
I saw Patti do that with them, and I just wrote on the...
Oh, I should say who we played. We just heard... that was Indiana Man by Community Currency, and before that, Certifiable by Signals. Burn Baby Doll by Gahanna. And we start off with Your Lamplight by Boy in Sleep. Some good stuff, man. These cats... from all around the world. Indiana. Switzerland.
Can I ask you, you know, like last week's show was just, I mean, you were, there was that father and son group from, you may not, remember.
Yeah, yeah, they're from Joshua Tree. But, you know, I try to find music from all over, and that's interesting to me. And there's a lot of people doing stuff. It's different than when I was younger. I think music was a smaller circle of people doing. Yeah, people give me stuff at gigs.
Yeah.
I get it all different kinds of ways.
Yeah,
this
other
stuff, this homebrew I'm into.
Thank you.
Water Under Mouse by Giant Face, and An Astronaut's Nightmare by the Korean Noise Research, then Peak Experience by Scotch Wiggly Band, and finally Lookout by Super Synth Modulation. Yeah, people going for it.
Yeah.
Okay, October 31st, 2009, Waffle Pedro Show. Happy Halloween, everybody. Yeah. Wear them costumes proudly and admit it. Keep your powder dry.